Hello, this is Terrence McNally. The greatest winner in the history of team sports, Bill Russell, died this week at the age of 88. Russell's Celtics won 11 NBA championships in his 13 years. He was voted most valuable player 5 times by his peers, was the first black head coach in a major U.S. sport, and his legacy as a man of principle and a leader on civil rights may be even greater than as an athlete. Here's my 2010 conversation with Aram Gutsuzian on his book, King of the Court, Bill Russell and the Basketball Revolution. In the second half, you'll hear my 2009 conversation with Cornel West, teacher, philosopher, author, activist, public intellectual, and one of my all-time favorite guests. Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome again to Pacifica and Free Forum. There's a lot of important and consequential events and news in the air. California holds a primary election Tuesday, as was just discussed. Israel killed 9, 10 or more in an attack in international waters on folks attempting to end its blockade of Gaza. BP's oil continues to gush into the sea and may well do so for another couple of months. Unemployment is not getting better, and the federal government has yet to give people and the states the help they desperately need to begin to turn that around. Program director Alan Minsky asked if the station could run a half-hour special hosted by Roy Ulrich on California's upcoming election in the second half today, and I said yes. Now, due to budget cuts, KPFK does not produce the amount of local news program we would like to, so when we can provide that kind of critical and useful news and information, I'm all for it. Stay tuned for that special full of information and recommendations from 12:30 to 1 p.m. But with just a half hour today, I'm not going to talk at length about any of those big stories I listed at the top. Another thing happened, by the way, this weekend in the news. Legendary UCLA basketball coach John Wooden died in his 100th year. And I'm not going to do my show today on Wooden. There were plenty of tributes happening elsewhere, and deservedly so. John Wooden was phenomenally successful in molding young men into a successful team, winning 88 straight games at one point and 10 consecutive NCAA championships. He did much of it at a time when college campuses were about many things other than basketball or teamwork. And I don't know everything about John Wooden, but he always struck me as inspired by our better angels. Two quick notes before I move on. The pyramid of success, a set of qualities or virtues that he developed over 14 years, was completed in 1948. That is nearly 20 years before his first national championship. So this is a guy who developed his philosophy and had it written down and stuck with it and then saw the enormous success blossom afterwards. The two Wooden quotes that stick with me the most: never mistake activity for achievement. And I have that one actually written at the top of my daily to-do list, because I think it's a terrible temptation in this very busy world we have. And then just one always worth remembering: failure to prepare is preparation for failure. So with the Los Angeles Lakers meeting the Boston Celtics for the 12th time in the NBA Finals, I'm going to risk some noise from local fans and devote my time today to the greatest Celtic of them all, Bill Russell. My guest will be Aram Gutsuzian, author of King of the Court, Bill Russell and the Basketball Revolution. But before I do, a few words about some of the other issues in the news. First, you can email me at temcnally@mac.com. T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, temcnally@mac.com. If you want me to email you a compilation of information and progressive recommendations on today's election. Now, these are not my personal endorsements, but the endorsements of a number of other individuals and organizations and background information. Again, that's temcnally@mac.com. You can also go to couragecampaign.org, couragecampaign, one word, .org, for a similar progressive voter's guide, though not as inclusive or thorough as the one that I will send you. Now, three propositions you must pay attention to. Prop 16 and 17 are each conceived, bought, and paid for by individual corporations, PG&E for 16 and Mercury Insurance for 17. No matter what the ads say, follow the money. I would say vote against a proposition that is 99 or 95% backed by one corporation. Prop 15, on the other hand, begins to move California in the direction of public financing of political campaigns. It makes it possible for local jurisdictions to initiate that kind of financing, and on the state level, it sort of does a pilot program by making the Secretary of State's office potentially publicly financed for the next two election cycles. This public finance of campaigns, anyone who listens to this show knows, is the reform I believe most essential to restore any semblance of citizen democracy to this state or this nation. So that's Prop 15. Now, regarding the deadly Israeli commando raid on the flotilla attempting to bring international aid, international pressure on Israel to end the blockade of Gaza, as well as bring humanitarian aid into Gaza. If you do not think you are getting the real story in U.S. mainstream media, you might check out a few other outlets, and I'm just going to give you a few here. One is Global Voices Online, one word, globalvoicesonline.com, which is a website that presents bloggers from all over the world. I can't, you know, vouch for who's in charge or anything, but at least it's a wide range of opinion, globalvoicesonline.com. Guardian.co.uk, that is the Guardian of London, which I find, you know, it's a mainstream paper in the UK, a progressive or left of center mainstream paper, but at least it's a very good journalistic organization who gives you a non-US point of view, and I find quite useful. Guardian.co.uk, Al Jazeera.net, AljazeeraNet, AljazeeraNet. I don't suppose I have to say too much about who that is. IndyMedia.org, IndyMedia.org. IndyMedia.org is indie media organizations around the world and in different cities. Alternet.org, Alternet, Alternet.org. It's a place where I publish, Maria Armudian publishes, I've seen others of Sonali Kohatkar publishes. There's a number of us that often take what we do on the air, turn it into print, and publish it at Alternet. Alternet, I find a very useful source of information, alternet.org. And of course, democracynow.org, who has been on this story and has a very vital website. Those same outlets are probably good sources of info regarding BP's oil gusher in the Gulf, along with grist.org, G-R-I-S-T, grist.org. By the way, let's get into a new practice here. Let's not call it the oil spill or the Gulf oil spill. Let's make sure to always include BP in whatever we call it. It's BP spill, BP's gusher, BP's leak, BP's catastrophe, okay? That's your homework from now on. Spread the word. This is not a Gulf disaster. This is a BP disaster. Also, in terms of the BP Gulf disaster, there's an interesting website, ifitwasmyhome.com. One word, ifitwasmyhome.com has a tool to help you visualize how big the area of the spill is. And currently, it is as big as Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Connecticut combined. It is as big as the nation of Costa Rica, and it is much bigger than the nation of Israel. ifitwasmyhome.com. Regarding jobs, I'm amazed and disappointed at Washington's response. Action that creates jobs will certainly create more jobs, as well as votes. Contact Congress and the White House daily. Just tell them jobs must be priority number one, certainly from now till November, and even more importantly, from now until things turn around. Now, to Bill Russell. By the way, you're listening to Free Forum on KPFK. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm about to bring in my guest, Aram Gudzusian. Bill Russell was not the first African-American to play professional basketball, but he was its first black superstar. He preceded Wilt Chamberlain by a couple of years. In 1956, Bill Russell won the second of two straight NCAA championships with the University of San Francisco. An Olympic gold medal, the U.S. winning by an average margin of 53.5 points a game, and he made his NBA debut with the Boston Celtics. From the moment he stepped onto the court of the Boston Garden, Russell began to transform the sport in a fundamental way, making him really more than any of his contemporaries the Jackie Robinson of basketball. His leaping, wide-ranging defense altered the game's texture both on defense and offense. His teams provided models of racial integration in the 50s, 60s, and in 1966, he became the first black coach of any major professional team sport. His Celtics won 11 NBA championships in 13 years. The only years they didn't were 1958, when he went down with an injury during the finals, and in 1967, his first season as player coach. But he won the next two seasons as player coach. Like no athlete before him, with the possible exception of Jack Johnson, Russell challenged the politics of sport. Instead of displaying appreciative deference, he decried racist institutions, he embraced his African roots, he challenged the nonviolent tenets of the civil rights movement. As the Celtics prepare to play the Los Angeles Lakers in Game 2 of the NBA Finals tonight at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, I welcome Aram Gadzoujian to talk about Bill Russell. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I believe have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, and today, sports, all because I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Aram Gadzoujian is an assistant professor of history at the University of Memphis, teaching courses in African-American history, including the history of the civil rights movement and the black athlete in American history. He's author of Sidney Poitier, Man, Actor, Icon, The Hurricane of 1938, and his latest, King of the Court, Bill Russell and the Basketball Revolution. Welcome, Aram Gadzoujian, to Pacifica and Free Forum.
Thanks for having me, Terrence. I appreciate it.
Very good. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. Well, you're an Armenian who teaches in Memphis, Tennessee, and has written books about two African-American icons. Tell us a little bit about what is, you know, on the face of it, kind of a counterintuitive personal path.
I like to say that I am the preeminent Armenian historian of African-Americans, but I don't know if that's true or not. Well, I actually grew up in the Boston area, which in some ways fed this newest project on Bill Russell. And, of course, there's a large Armenian community there, as there is, of course, in Southern California.
Yeah.
And I got interested in African-American history simply because I was interested in American culture, and particularly in American popular culture. I was fascinated by the politics of sports and the politics of movies. You know, my first book was about Sidney Poitier, who was the only black leading man of the 1960s during the civil rights era. And there was a lot of political debates that revolved around his image and his career. So I didn't come into graduate school and training to be a professional historian with the idea that I was just going to study African Americans or that I'd be teaching African American history, but that's where the path has led me. And it's been a great journey. Now I live in Memphis, a city that's about 50% African American, and when I teach courses in African American history, I often have 80%, 90% of my students are black. So it gives me a new perspective, it gives me new challenges, and new rewards. It's been a great journey.
Talk a little bit about that interaction in the classroom, where you are a young Armenian professor from Boston, and you're teaching, you know, the civil rights movement and that sort of thing to a class that is, as you say, over 50% black.
Right. Well, you know, I often open a class on the first day with just sort of general questions about why we're there in the first place. Why would you study history? And what lessons can we learn from it? And how is it sort of a journey into who you are? And whenever I'm teaching a course in African-American history, well, I always, you know, at some point in the class, you know, the students start talking about how studying African American history is important to them because it helps them figure out who they are and so on. And then I always, you know, tend to crack the joke. Well, I'm like, if you've been paying attention, you'll have noticed that I am not African American. So, you know, is African American history just for black people? And that's sort of what spurs them to think about sort of the contributions of African Americans to all aspects of American life, the meaning of American democracy, the Constitution of the American workforce, the meaning of the Constitution, all these issues.
What do you make of the fact, you pointed it out, and I've read it in other things you've written, that your interest was first in popular culture, I think, and then in the role of African Americans in popular culture? What do you make of the, let's say, at least way out of proportion to their percentage in the population, their impact in popular culture, whether sports, entertainment, etc.?
Well, I think part of it is because aspects of African American culture are very much focused upon issues that relate to sports, entertainment. And these are, you know, the sort of the musical traditions, for instance, within African-American culture have shaped this incredible contribution to American music. The focus on sports is sort of a, you know, at a time when African-Americans were segregated and had few avenues into political power or economic power. Popular culture and entertainment and sports were ways in which they could achieve success. So, you know, from the early 20th century, at least, you know, sport was sort of central to the African-American experience. And that has, in a lot of ways, shaped their contributions into the more modern era.
Okay. And I, as people who've studied American culture will know, that is also something which has happened to immigrant populations along the way. Right. In
mm-hmm.
other words, there is a point at which one thing which I meant to raise with you, which I found interesting. Sports Illustrated had an article recently on genetics of athletes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you saw it, but
I did. Yeah.
And one of the funniest things it pointed out to me was that there was a period when people speculated that Jews had a particular genetic predisposition for basketball. Because Jews of the New York and other inner cities were dominating basketball performance.
Yeah, Jews dominated basketball in the 1920s and into the 1930s, and even into the 1950s. You know, a lot of great NBA players were Jewish. Dolph Shays was a leading scorer in the NBA when he retired in the mid 1960s. Was Jewish, but yeah, it's basketball's sort of always been the city game. You know, whoever populates America's cities tend to thrive at it. And in the early 20th century, that was Jews.
Right.
African Americans were not part of basketball in its earliest traditions for the most part, because most African Americans did not live in cities.
Exactly. It has much more to do with who was the dominant athlete in the inner city than what race you actually are. Let me tell people that I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Aram Gadzousian about his latest book, King of the Court, Bill Russell and the Basketball Revolution and the Unique Man at the Center of That Book. This is Free Forum, KPFK, 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming and podcasting at kpfk.org. You can visit me at terrencemcnally.net. That's one word, TerrenceMcNally. NALLY, TerrenceMcNally.net, to learn more about the show, guests, podcasts, transcripts, etc. You can sign up there or at iTunes to receive the weekly podcast. You can also email me there or at TEMcNally@Mac.com, TEMcNally@Mac.com, to sign up for my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about. Can you talk a little bit about the cultural moment in the 50s while winning those two NCAA championships and the gold medal? Russell resented popular expectations that black athletes exude humility and deference. What was that culture of the black athlete to which Russell emerged?
Well, when Russell emerged as really the first black superstar of college basketball, there had never really been a player like him, in the sense that, you know, he sort of redefined how to play defense in basketball. You look at the coaching manuals from the time, and you talk to some of the coaches from the time, and they say you never leave your feet on defense. You do not jump up in any circumstance, because then there's, you know, someone can fake and go right by you for a layup. But Russell really changed that because of his incredible timing and his leaping ability and the way that he studied the game. He made jumping sort of central to how you play defense and using the block shot not just as a physical weapon but a psychological weapon. And he understood this by his junior year of college in a way that even he thinks that his coach didn't really understand it. So the media was very always skeptical of his talents, especially because this is at a time when he's playing on the West Coast. New York is considered the mecca of college basketball. And he doesn't even, you know, cross the Mississippi to play basketball until his senior year, after they've won a national championship, when they go to a tournament at Madison Square Garden. So there's this resentment toward Russell that he feels, as well as a skepticism that kind of shapes how he will view the media from then on. And part of it is because of his skin color, there's a sense that he thinks that they're not appreciating him in the way that they do other college superstars like Tom Gola. And the other part is just that he feels like he's playing the game in a way that people don't yet understand how important it is.
But I was also saying in terms of other than than Russell himself. In other words, Jackie Robinson had integrated Major League Baseball And followed by, you know, several others. So by this point, 1956, which is when he first plays for the Boston Celtics, baseball is integrated. Football has been integrated. There were stars, you know, in the late 40s, early 50s who were black, Marion Motley, et cetera. Jim Brown is already playing, I believe. Although at that point, I will just say, I grew up in the South. I grew up in Florida. And when you lived in Jacksonville, Florida, the Sunday pro football game that you got when I was growing up was the Washington Redskins. They were considered the local team for the South. Why? Well, I guess Washington may have been the most southernmost team, but they were also the last team to hire a black athlete. So what I'm saying is, and boxing, of course, had a population of blacks. But it's this attitude of deference. It's this attitude of the way that a black athlete was supposed to present himself to the public. So I'm asking two things. One, what was the norm, and what was Russell?
Well, the pattern was established, really, especially with Joe Louis and Jesse Owens in the 1930s. And you saw that Jackie Robinson had to live by those dictates when he integrated Major League Baseball in the late 1940s. And that was sound appreciative. Never talk back, don't be seen with white women, don't be seen as too friendly with white people, don't talk, you know, don't come across it in any way as anything besides humble and deferential. And Russell, in his early career, I wouldn't say that in the 1950s that he necessarily broke that code, but you could see him resisting that code in certain ways. There's an interview done with him in Sports Illustrated in 1958, in which he says, I don't want people to stereotype me ever. He refused to drive a Cadillac simply because that was a stereotype that when a black athlete got rich, they would drive a Cadillac. At a time when people were wearing suits in a particular way, he insisted that his suits get cut in an entirely different way because he didn't want to be thought of in one particular sort of way. But by the early 60s, he's really snapped that code entirely. He's blaming the NBA for having a racial quota that no team has more than four or five blacks on each roster. This is in 1963-64. And NBA owners get outraged, and his own owner is furious with him. But he's right. You know, a team does have more than four or five blocks. And the next year, teams start to break that quota.
Let me cut in for just a second, Aram. Sure. Aram Gazizian, author of King of the Court, because I found in your foreword to your book by Harry Edwards, he has a wonderful quote about that. He said that reporters, he always was wary, Russell was wary of reporters and actually said that that anything a black athlete said could later be used against them. But shortly after he was named player coach of the Celtics in 1968, a reporter asked what Harry Edwards calls a trap question, which was, what is the right number of black players to play? And Russell's answer, I don't know that there is a right number, but in the NBA, the tradition is to play two black players at home, three on the road, and five when you get behind, which I think has to come with the Russell cackle.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
That's for sure. So in other ways, too, Russell is really resisting sort of what he considers the trappings of celebrity culture and hero worship. Like, he refuses to sign autographs because he thinks they don't mean anything. And he did it early in his career, but all of a sudden, in about 1964, he just plumb decides that, nope, I'm not going to sign autographs anymore. If there's ever an example of an athlete sort of breaking away from just sort of the popular expectations of what they do, there it is. And when you think about it, autographs are kind of dumb. What does it mean to write your name on a piece of paper?
What does it mean about the relationship between the two of us, that you will never see me for another moment, and something about me makes my signature on a piece of paper worth something to you? I think it's that whole craziness about that. Go ahead.
So by the late 60s, when really the time that people call the revolt of the black athlete, and that people like Harry Edwards, who wrote the foreword to the book, are sort of at the forefront in terms of the proposed Olympic boycott and the black power salute at the Olympics, Russell is way ahead of that. I mean, he is in a lot of ways shaping the ideology of these younger athletes, even before Muhammad Ali. You could really say that it's Bill Russell, Jim Brown, and Muhammad Ali who are, by the early 60s, really starting to shape how this next generation of black athletes is going to think about their social role in a way that's radically different from how black athletes in the 50s have thought about it. They're sort of the three central figures, I think, in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Again, I'm speaking with Aram Gazizian. The book is King of the Court, Bill Russell and the Basketball Revolution. It is a study of Bill Russell as an athlete, as a person, and his role in American culture. He says, I'm going to read a quote here, writing of racism in his own memoir, Go Up for Glory. He said, "It stood out, a wall which understanding cannot penetrate. You are a Negro. You are less. It covered every area, a living, smarting, hurting, smelling, greasy substance which covered you, a morass to fight from." What were his experiences, you detail them in the book, as before his prominence and then even during his prominence of racism?
Well, he grew up in Louisiana. He grew up in West Monroe, Louisiana, and lived there until he was about 9 years old. So he experienced Jim Crow directly in that regard and when he would go back to visit relatives. He moved to Oakland during World War II with his parents and with his older brother in search of economic opportunity, like many African Americans did, and there found sort of a de facto Jim Crow. Segregation might not have been the law there, but there were restaurants that didn't welcome black people, and there were police that would call them nigger, and there were and there was sort of a de facto economic segregation and neighborhood segregation. When he enters into professional, or even when he enters into college sports, there's all these ways in which he is being, you know, he's the campus hero and the big man on campus and all that. But at the same time, when they go to play in Oklahoma, for instance, the fans throw pennies at him and tell him to pick him up, like he's a circus clown or something like that. When he was an excellent track athlete as well. And one time the school sent him to a meet in St. Louis, and they registered him in a hotel. But then when he showed up at the hotel, they wouldn't let him stay there because they didn't know he was black, and there was a hotel that did not accept black people. He had to sleep in his car. So early in his career, he's getting shaped by these moments, so that later on, when he's a professional athlete, those scars are with him. He's an introspective and sensitive person, and he's not the sort of person who can shrug those things away. They stick with him. One of the things that was really remarkable to me as I was talking to a lot of Russell's old teammates, especially his white teammates in the early 60s, was they said they had no sense of Russell's bitterness whatsoever, that they were totally shocked in the way that he remembered and stored away all of these things that had happened to him in the 1950s and the early 1960s that really came out by the mid-1960s.
Uh-huh. You know what? I've got to end this conversation so we can get to that election special in the second half, but I really recommend, as we're watching the finals and we're enjoying the great rivalry between the Lakers and the Celtics, King of the Court by Aram Ghazouzian, and I recommend Russell's own books as well. He was an amazing figure. I went back and listened to a couple of interviews with him in preparation for this and just found my admiration for him all the more. The book is King of the Court, Bill Russell and the Basketball Revolution. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do that either at iTunes or at terrencemcnally.net. You can sign up to have a weekly announcement email from me on who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and some background. You can sign up for that at terrencemcnally.net or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com. This program will be archived for the next 90 days at kpfk.org. Check audio archives, scroll down by date and time. I look forward to being with you again next week. We'll be asking you to support us in our summer fun drive, and I hope to include excerpts from an interview I will do this week with Newsweek's Jonathan Alter about his book, The Promise, and I'm going to try to find out what was really going on behind the scenes when Barack Obama was making all those decisions that have disappointed his progressive base as much as they have. One more time, you can email me at temcnally@mac.com if you want me to email you a compilation of information and progressive recommendations on Tuesday's election. You can also get a slate card, a progressive slate card, by going to couragecampaign.org. Stay tuned for KPFK's election special with Roy Ulrich, followed by explorations with physicist Michio Kaku at 1 p.m. Thank you, Aram Ghazouzian, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
This is Terrence McNally. In the second half, you'll hear my 2009 conversation with Cornel West, teacher, philosopher, author, activist, public intellectual, and one of my all-time favorite guests on his memoir, Brother West. Hello, I'm Terry McNally, and welcome to Free Forum. Let me read a couple of quotes from my next guest. "The capacity to produce social chaos is the last resort of desperate people." Another, "You can't lead the people if you don't love the people, and you can't save the people if you don't serve the people." There's music in those words, as well as pain, wisdom, and honesty. Those are the words of Cornel West. Every time I see that Dr. West is going to be in L.A., I try to get him in the studio with me. I'll tell you why. He's not only fiercely intelligent, boldly articulate, and politically passionate, but in our first interview, I found him to be one of the best listeners and most humble conversationalists I've ever interviewed. For someone who speaks in highly quotable near paragraphs at times, Cornel West probably said, "You know, I hadn't thought of it that way," or "I'm going to have to think about that," more than any other person I've interviewed in over a decade of doing this show. And that means a lot to me. Very often people say, "How did an interview go?" I say, "They couldn't make it a conversation. You know, they had to do their stump speech. They're on their tour and they did the same old, but not Dr. West." Cornel West has just come out with his memoir, Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud. In it, he writes, "Until now, I've never taken the time to focus on the inner dynamics of my soul." On Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Educator and philosopher Dr. Cornel West is the class of 1943 University Professor of Religion and African American Studies at Princeton University. He's won numerous awards, including the American Book Award, and has received more than 20 honorary degrees. He's produced 3 CDs of music and spoken word, offers commentary on the Tavis Smiley Show, and is the author of several books, including Race Matters, Democracy Matters, Hope on a Tightrope, and as I said, his latest, Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud. Welcome again, Cornel West, to KPFK and Freeform.
It's always a blessing to be on Freeform, and my dear brother Terry, we've had some wonderful times together, and those are some very kind and generous words that you say, I tell you.
But I wouldn't say them if they weren't true. I've said it over the years, actually.
I appreciate that.
So I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. Well, in this case, that's what the whole book is about.
Yeah, that's true.
How did this book happen?
Brother Tad was smiling. He said, "Doc," he said, "Brother West," he said, I would love to see you put on paper who you are." He said, "Who are you really?" I said, "Well, as Augustine says, I'm a mystery to myself. I haven't examined the dark precincts of my own personality." And so I had a chance to do this, and along with my dear brother David Ritz, of course, who's such a towering artist when it comes to story, narrative, capturing voice. So I want to make sure that this was a conversational voice. It's a talking book in that sense. And because I aspire to be a blues man in the life of the mind and a jazz man in the world of ideas, I wanted somebody who had a sensibility to capture the voice of a blues man. And, of course, beginning with Mom and Dad, Irene and Cliff, Sacramento, Shiloh Baptist Church, the neighborhood, sports, girlfriends and things, I wanted to really lay bare what the making of this particular instance of a tradition, because I really am a person and I have my own individuality and I try to forge my own voice and style, but I'm very much a part of a tradition. I'm not a self-made man. You know that American myth that goes back to Ben Franklin and even elements of it in Frederick Douglass, that I'm the opposite of that. I am in no way self-made. I come out of a tradition, community, a struggle a heritage that exemplifies struggle for justice and freedom. And I'm very blessed to be a part of the family and that tradition and community.
You know, you said Tavis Smiley, because I do know from reading some of this, and you said that he's the one who said, we need it, do
yeah,
it.
Absolutely.
What role did your cancer diagnosis play in it?
Well, that's a good question, though, brother. I think that in some way, you know, my struggling with cancer was a intensifying of my dance with mortality. And death has a way of arresting the mind, as Samuel Johnson used to put it. And so I there's no doubt, you're absolutely right, that the near-death experience of cancer did make me think about the life that I have lived. And I should say that telling one's life story is itself a life-transforming experience.
How so?
That you begin to really slow down. I'm on the move all the time, you know, over 200 events every year for 25, 30 years, and you have to just stop, engage in serious retrospection in terms of not just the events passing, but the deeper meaning and significance as it affected your heart, mind, and soul, and loved ones.
Let me ask you, you've written many books. You write a lot. You're telling me there's something qualitatively different. You could, I'm guessing, you could write some of those other books on the plane, between things. This one was different.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say on the plane. I'm still in the library. But, I mean, if I'm writing, you know, History of American Pragmatism from Emerson to Richard Rorty with Quine and Peirce and James and Dewey and others, I could write that in the library, engaging with the text. Whereas this book is just me and the realities and the page.
Yeah.
That's it.
And all the choices then become, how deep do I go? What do I mention?
That's right. How far do I pursue certain kinds of issues? When it gets painful, it really hurts. When it's joyful, you want to stay there for a long time, but you've got to shift. So you're absolutely right. It's a very different kind of process. And I'd always vowed that I would hold off on doing something like this because, I don't know, maybe just my Christian formation, you know, that a preoccupation with self for too long leads toward a kind of narcissism and a egocentrism that I abhor. And so I had to somehow walk this balance between telling a story about myself that revealed the degree to which I am tied, intertwined, entangled with mom, dad, sisters, brothers, friends, comrades, and so on. But on the other hand, I did have to focus just on me, too. Yes.
And for people who just heard us mention cancer but don't know how it turned out, your original word was much more threatening than luckily it turned out, correct?
Absolutely. Well, when I found out about the prostate cancer, they said you had the most aggressive form. It's the last stage. You might have a few months to live. And I said, ooh, wow, I better slow down. And I said to myself, I said, well, you know, I've been invited to the banquet of life for 48 years. I had an abundance of blessings, so I can't get greedy about this. If it's time to go, it's time to go. I accept my fate. That's God's will. That's cool. I've already lived such unbelievable life that death cannot in any way rob me of the joys I've already experienced and the love I've already had. On the other hand, I said, I've got to gear up and fight. Because I do love life now. I love to live, even though I'm blessed to live. And thank God, Brother Peter Scardino, one of the finest of doctors in the country dealing with prostate cancer, went in radical surgery. 6 hours later, I'm bouncing back, and here I am still going and borrow time, even though we all got a death sentence in time and space. Sooner or later, you got to go.
Right, right.
But not at the moment.
Right. Born astride the grave, right?
Yes. That's Samuel Beckett. That's my dear Beckett.
To jump from yourself, well, wait, no, let's stay with yourself a little bit more. You say that this book really began in a church in Sacramento. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, I think I wanted to start actually after giving people a sense of my travels and so on, because I'm on the move all the time. I don't think I've spent one weekend in Princeton ever in my life.
And let me just cut in for people who haven't seen the documentary An Examined Life, which you're one of the philosophers that they interview in that. Yours actually, I think, is in a moving car.
That's true.
That's
true. I was on my way to a lecture. I was on the way there. Absolutely. Well, we had a lot of fun with Sister Taylor in that movie. But it does start in Shiloh. My brother is being ordained as a deacon. My mother's tears are flowing. And it hits me that in the end, I am still a Shiloh Baptist kind of brother. I may be a philosopher with a groove. I may be a person who has an attitude of gratitude in terms of being thankful for what I have and a freedom fighter and someone who has tremendous joy and delight in music of various kinds. But fundamentally, I'm a Shiloh Baptist kind of brother. That's what has shaped me, the music, the styles, the love, the preoccupation of a first century Palestinian Jew named Jesus who was put to death by a vicious Roman Empire. Innocent blood flowing on the one hand, but compassion still responding to that imperial blow and assault against Jesus. That's what shaped me. And that's kind of the substratum.
Yeah.
of who I am.
I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Cornel West. He's Princeton professor, multimedia citizen, and the author most recently of Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud. It's a memoir, and that's the book we're talking about right now. This is Freeform on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming a podcast in kpfk.org. You can learn more about Dr. West's work at cornelwest.com, more about this show and how to get in touch with me at terrymcnally.net. I do want to go, the youth, we've got a sense of that a little bit. Let me jump because you and I, as we said off air before we started, share a little bit. I got to Harvard in 1965, and though I am white, I know I was an affirmative action kind of a kid. We were poor. I was Catholic. I was from the South. And I remember being so intimidated by the folks who'd come from the prep schools and what I had walked into. How about yourself?
Intimidated might be too strong a word. I just knew that they came from another planet. There's no doubt about that. I mean, they were human, but there's an alienness about them. Their style and their sometimes a confidence that verged on arrogance. And here I'm from Sacramento, California. I'm very kind of comfortable in my skin. I knew it was going to be a challenge because my public high school was in no way commensurate with Exeter or Andover or
same
Choate
here, yeah.
And so forth. You know. But on the other hand, I always felt I had something to bring. You know what I mean? I mean, I guess part of it just had to do with, you know, I had Curtis Mayfield and the White Brothers had the Beach Boys, and I just thought Curtis was deeper than Brian Wilson and company, as much as I appreciate Wilson and the boys. So that I always knew I had something to bring, even as I had to be open to learn and listen. And that's what Harvard was, as it was for you. Marx and Weber and Durkheim and Kant and Hegel and Nietzsche and Schopenhauer and Plato and Aristotle and Descartes and Hume. I'm just like, oh, my God, it's a whole new world.
Yeah. And the other students.
The students themselves.
It was like, whoa, the challenge, the creative tension just of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things that I noticed at Harvard was I always felt as if, at least at that time, that many of we young black folk, we had a certain spiritual depth and a certain kind of moral sensitivity that gave us that was a source of strength. So even the folk who had been exposed intellectually, you got the feeling they were socially underdeveloped. And they were spiritually, if not impoverished, on the verge of it. And so there was an interesting kind of give and take that took place. You know, and of course, I just use the music as one indicator, but there's other ways as well.
No.
How you relate to people, how you negotiate in context, how do you respond to new circumstances.
That's
and
right.
So
the
forth.
Truth is that folks like us were new to them.
Exactly. And see, they had been in that same bubble. From seventh grade.
That's
you know,
right.
You go from Exeter all the way to Harvard, that's the same bubble.
Yeah.
You and I, we're in a different situation.
Yeah.
From the South, white brother, Catholic, you going into WASDom. I'm black, Sacramento, I'm going into WASDom, but it WASD elite.
Yeah.
And, you know, we knew that we had much to learn from them, but they had something to learn from us, too.
Absolutely.
Now.
You know, I had Skip Gates in here a few years ago. We talked about his experience as well. As I'm sitting here talking to you, I'm reminded of his recent experience. And in reading an interview, you said that you actually were questioned about a crime while at Harvard.
Oh, I almost went to jail. They had charges of rape against me and two of my roommates, a white sister who had been raped. And we were put on a line, and the police actually put pressure on the sister, saying, you know one of these three did it. She said, no, a Negro did it, but not these Negroes. And I salute that white sister. She was courageous in her bearing witness to truth and justice, because I'd been in a cell right now, probably.
Yeah.
So in that regard, the issue of arbitrary police power has always been a crucial issue in poor communities and in poor black communities, poor brown and so forth. And, you know, you can't just end it with a beer summit and think it's over. This is very real. You want to find out the facts, make sure everybody's treated fairly. But arbitrary police power is no plaything at all.
Well, I mean, if we go back to, I saw when Barack Obama responded to the question in the press conference. That's and at that point, he was...
That was a gut response.
It was a gut response.
That was a gut response. And then he became the politician that he's such a master at these days.
Yeah, let's talk...
about calculating and strategizing.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about Barack Obama. Let
God
me say, I saw Michael Moore's movie last night.
I saw it,
you know,
too.
Powerful movie.
Powerful.
My fiance said the moment that was the saddest for her was watching how excited people were the night Barack Obama was elected.
Yeah.
Share a little bit, if you would, Cornel West, about your feelings that night and your feelings today.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was ready because I draw a radical distinction between the symbolic and the substantial. That as a critical supporter of Barack Obama and engaged in over 50 events from him from Iowa to Ohio, I knew that at a symbolic level something was could happen that was unprecedented, and it did happen. And at that symbolic level, I can understand the tears, I can understand the jubilation, I can understand the euphoria. But I always knew that there was a sense in which him now heading the American empire, tied to the shadow government, tied to CIA, FBI, tied to the establishment waiting to embrace him. It was clear when he chose his economic team, when he chose his foreign policy team, he was choosing, of course, some recycled neoliberals and recycled neoclintonites, that substantially you're going to end up with these technocratic policies that consider poor people and working people as afterthoughts, beginning with bankers, beginning with elites. Symbolically, black man breakthrough makes you want to break dance. So we had to be able to relate to both of these. So I resonate with your dear fiance because of the hopes that were generated and the call for change. And then we end up with this recycled neoliberalism. There's no fundamental change at all.
Yeah.
That's very real. But I think we do have to understand we had to bring the age of Reagan to a close.
Yes.
We had to bring the era of conservatism to a close. And then you try to unleash new possibilities. And the question now is, how do we keep our fellow citizens awakened so it goes beyond the campaign for a candidate and really begins to engage in grassroots organizing and mobilize?
Yeah. One of the things that I've also felt myself is that I'm more disheartened these days than I was during the 8 years of Bush. During the 8 years of Bush, I expected nothing. You know, I was surprised by almost nothing. And you know, we fought. We did what we could. This one gets a little sadness in my soul as I watch it.
Yeah.
And I know that you've talked about that Obama's looking at the wrong Lincoln. That Lincoln or Roosevelt, who shows so well in Michael Moore's movie with the new Bill of Rights.
For freedom.
But that Roosevelt came to power as a moderate. Lincoln came to power as someone who had worked very comfortably with slavery.
Absolutely.
And it was the movements, it was the people.
That's right.
That challenged and inspired them. How are we doing and how are we going to do?
We are not doing well at all. If you look at the abolitionist movement and its impact on Abraham Lincoln, the Frederick Douglasses, the Harriet Beecher Stowes, author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, Wendell Phillips, Charles Sumner, all of those tyrants, William Lloyd Garrison, we can go on Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman. It was an abolitionist movement that was powerful. Put pressure on Lincoln. Trade union movement. Put pressure on FDR. What kind of movement do we have? Hardly anything at all. That's where the analogy breaks down.
Yeah.
And that's in part where, you know, Barack Obama then leans toward the Wall Street, mesmerized by the elites, wants to be embraced by the establishment, wants to preserve his legacy as a president, more in the language of the neoliberal and neoconservative columnists than in the hearts and minds of everyday people.
Yeah. So we both agree the age of Reagan, and again, Moore lays it out very well for people who haven't seen that film yet. You know, this election does say that's over, but it doesn't say what's starting, does it?
That's true. I mean, even my dear brother Michael Moore tends to, I think, put too much confidence in Barack Obama. Even in the film, you get this sense that here comes Barack Obama speaking the language of a deep Democrat.
Yeah.
No. He's been a liberal all of his life. He's using that language to mobilize, but in the end, he's going to capitulate and defer to the neoliberal establishment, which is what he has done so far. Now, granted, I mean, there's still some possibilities there, you know, even when you talk about just extending unemployment benefits. This is nothing revolutionary at all, but it does alleviate some of the suffering. But if we don't get some restructuring going on, and if we don't get some Marshall Plan activity of massive investment
in this country,
in the infrastructure here, you got $4 billion every month in Afghanistan. And you can come up with that all the time.
The meter just runs when we're at war.
The meter just runs. Unlimited. It's very pathetic, to tell you the truth.
I'm Terry McNally. That's the voice of Cornel West, a Princeton professor, a multimedia master, author, most recently of Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud, a memoir. And you can learn more about his work at cornelwest.com. We talked a little bit about Larry Summers last time. Just briefly, you had personal experiences with him, but he really means a lot to you symbolically in terms of Obama, yes?
He does, I think, because Larry Summers, and I would say I forgive him in terms of disrespecting and dishonoring me. I just draw my own lines in the sand. But I won't demonize the brother. I pray for the brother. I want to live a life of joy. I don't think there's too much joy in disrespecting people. So I wouldn't choose that way of life myself. But the thing is that he has a braininess that lacks wisdom and vision. And he has a smartness that lacks a sensitivity to the poor and the marginal. So that kind of braininess and smartness, you and I encountered a lot of that at Harvard. I don't find that attractive or appealing at all. I think that it's empty. A certain sense. And I was just surprised that Barack Obama could be seduced by that kind of braininess and smartness that really has policies that don't put jobs at the center. It's an afterthought.
Yeah, and houses. And homes.
And homes. Yeah. Exactly. And homes. Absolutely.
Yeah. As I've said and I've said on the show before, it's like, do they ever ask the question, so how do we save the banks? I don't hear them asking the question, how do we save the people?
The people, absolutely. And you would think it would follow from some of the populist language that Brother Obama used during the campaign. But who is around the table when he, you know, shapes his policy? You don't have any people representing the labor movement other than our Secretary of Labor.
Well, on health reform. When he has doctors, there's the doctor who represents single payer has to crash the party.
That's exactly right.
I mean,
I mean, it's that kind of reflection of just how broken the system is. You got a majority of fellow citizens who want universal health care, and he can't even view public option as indispensable and untouchable. You
say,
what's going on? Pharmaceutical companies, drug companies. Powerful. $300 million spent for lobbyists. That's a broken system.
Yeah. It's a terrible, terrible. I have often said that unless we get public financing, that every other issue will always, you'll look in, you know, at the distant goal and you'll end up, you know, on
That's
the 10-yard line.
That's exactly right.
And I often say, you know, if we all just put aside every other issue for a year or two
just
and said one thing we're doing, public finance and public.
That's
now, of course, as
true.
You know, Supreme Court
That's
might
right.
rule that corporations can give unlimited funds, changing a 100-year precedent for this conservative court. That day, which may come soon, I don't know what happens then because I'm not sure that the public will understand what that means.
What that really means. It means we're locked in an iron cage of a neoliberal mediocrity or neoconservative mediocrity, which means the needs of the people will never be fundamentally met if they're poor and working class. And that either leads toward a thickening of the cynicism or it leads toward new expressions of social chaos.
Right. Going back to that first quote
Going back
I read.
To the first
that's the
quote.
That's the articulation of desperate people.
That's exactly right.
Let me finally, we've got about 3 minutes. Let me ask you, you really do talk about music a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And see yourself, as you say, a blues man in a blues soaked America. What's Cornel West blues these days?
The power of love, the power of education, love itself, of other people, of wisdom, of justice, but also being open enough to be vulnerable enough to muster the courage to think critically, to re-examine and re-scrutinize, re-interrogate who we are, where we're going, similarly so for society, similarly so for the world. And when you bring together that power of love on the one hand, where it's fundamental commitment to the welfare of others, especially beginning with the least of these. And I go back again to prophetic Judaism, which is, of course, the very source of my own Christianity, the first chapter of Isaiah, the orphan, the widow, the fatherless, the oppressed, and then mediated through this love in which justice is what love looks like in public. So you're fighting for justice, motivated by compassion, raising Socratic questions. And blues, for me, is the lyrical expression of that power of love and that power of awakening that's associated with deep education. And so I am a blues man and a life of the mind and a jazz man in the world of ideas, and blessed to be a part of a great tradition. And that can go from Louis Armstrong to Stephen Sondheim or Harold Arlen, or Tennessee Williams in literary blues, B.B. King, Toni Morrison, Ralph Ellison, James Baldwin, or it could be an everyday person on the block who can't sing in pitch, but whose life is shaped by the power of love and the power of democratic reawakening through their own forms of education.
And I'm listening to the people you say fall in this pantheon of blues. What is it that unites them? It has something to do with soul.
Yes. It has something to do with...
And it has a little something to do with pain.
After it begins, Ralph Ellison says, blues is an autobiographical chronicle of a personal catastrophe expressed lyrically. In Sondheim, you get the catastrophic, Into the Woods, flip over the fairy tale. You see, the catastrophic in Kafka, you begin with the transformation into a huge, foul vermin. That's catastrophic for Gregor. Strange Fruit the Southern Trees Bear, Billie Holiday, Jewish brother Maripol wrote the lyrics. Jim Crow, American Terrorism, that's catastrophic. And B.B. King says, nobody loves me but my mama, and she might be jiving too. That is catastrophic. What you gonna do? Compassion still flows. Sing your song.
Great.
Keep moving.
Thank you.
Thank you so much,
Thank
my dear
you,
brother
Cornel.
Terry. Again, always a blessing, man.
His website is cornelwest.com. The new book is Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud, a memoir. You can listen to this week's conversation, many others, anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can also sign up to have it delivered weekly for podcasts, articles, transcripts. Join me in pursuit of a world that just might work at terrymcnally.net. And you can sign up there for my weekly announcement or email me at temcnally@mac.com. Tell me you want to get that weekly announcement. This program is going to be archived for the next 90 days at kpfk.org. Check audio archives, scroll down by date and time. Thank you to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, Matt Perez in traffic, to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week. Cornel West, keep up the good work.
You keep up the good work, my brother.
Thank you.
I love you much, mate.